Hi and welcome to the Australasian Special Events 2020 project. I'm Trevor Connell, and like all of you, I'm currently practicing physical distancing from my friends and peers. But rather than being stuck in social isolation, each week I'm Zooming in with someone who has made a career in our event industry and asking them to share their story. This week I chat to David Green, Managing Director at DG Global Events. David, what's your story?
Well, I was born in South Perth in 1967. Back then, things were a little different, obviously, in the 60s. But yeah, I was born in South Perth and I grew up in a little suburb in south of the river, because over there in Perth, there's the south of the river and the north of the river, the big competition. It's probably not unsimilar to Sydney. And we lived in a little Sleepy Hollow suburb called Brentwood, which as I got older in latter years, Brentwood was quite an affluent suburb in Los Angeles. So many movie stars live there. But when you're growing up and everything else in Brentwood, little did you know that there was another place in the world that actually was full of movie stars and part of the whole Hollywood scene. So I grew up in Brentwood and, mum and dad had a beach house down the coast in a place called Mandra, which was called Miami back then. And we probably spent 50% of our time at that beach house on weekends. And then from Brentwood Primary, I went on to Rosmoyne High School, which came to be quite an academic school in latter years, and it was right up there with the performance. But that kind of wasn't me. I spent a lot of time staring out the window in high school. And got out of school pretty much just after I turned 15.
And then what happened?
Well, I was, little did I know it, but sort of I had a right brain, left brain struggle most of my life, and I only worked that out not long ago because someone suggested me go and see a bloody kinesiologist, which I didn't know what it was. I had to Google that. Someone to talk to about, everything at the end of the day, because I think everybody needs someone to talk to, and mental health wasn't a thing back then. And as 50-plus-year-old men, we seem to fight that. So I thought, I'm going to go and talk to this person. And, she basically said I was a left-brain, right-brain bloody at war for most of my life. So I got out of school at 15, and I got an apprenticeship as an electrician. Which, look, in all honesty, it was a way to get out of school. It was something that you did back then, was get an apprenticeship and start working. But after about 12 months, that didn't pan out, and the guy that I worked for was struggling, which happens when you're a subcontractor or a contractor, which a lot of people out there today would understand that. So I got out of that, and as I grew up, a lot of my mates and friends and that I'd met through surfing, I've surfed all my life, so they were down at John Curtin School, and then they were at Whopper, which is obviously where Heath Ledger was and Hugh Jackman in the latter years and everything else, and they were all doing the jazz course at Whopper, and musicians and many bands and things were happening around that time, and I was kind of 17, sneaking into pubs with a fake ID and everything that you did. And I just took a passion to music and that industry. And, it kind of made sense back then that that industry was about working at night and I wanted to go surfing during the day. So I was sort of, I started being a roadie, as you would say, like back then in probably 84, 85 for all my mates' bands. And, the old parkhands with the old bloody switchboard that used to turn the lights on and off with the actual PowerPoint, the actual board. And, we started doing a lot of gigs, and one guy in particular, Ashley Manning, had amazing talent. And I think he was way ahead of his time. He asked me if I'd manage the band. So it was a three-piece band back in the era, I guess, of Spy versus Spy, for any of those that remember that. They were sort of our competition, as in, they paved the way for three-piece bands back then, Spy versus Spy. And then
they were Brisbane, weren't they? Spy versus Spy?
Brisbane, Sydney. I can't quite remember. You bloody tested my bloody memory. So Ashley was an extremely talented human, and you know, he was very ambitious, and as I was, and we were very naive. So I took on the management of them in 85. I think I was 17 and a bit, 18, and started my own record company. And I had a label called Mission Records because that made sense. We were on a mission. And a guy called Michael Pappas, who had a little bloody record manufacturing vinyl plant down in Surry Hills in Sydney, cut our first single. And we released that on the independent charts. And it did all right. We recorded it at Planet Sound Studios, which is no longer there, which John Villani and Graham Owens had back in the day. It was in Subiaco, and it was a state-of-the-art world-class studio back then. And a guy called Pixie Michaels, who I believe Pixie might still be around doing something in Sydney. He was the front-of-house engineer and the guy from a band called Perfect Strangers way back in the day, managed by Greg Green, which was a company he had called Bottomline. And he set himself up in Sydney and did very well. So we recorded all that, did all that, and then... it was a bit of a Spinal Tap moment. I don't know if you've seen the movie Spinal Tap, have you, Trev? Yeah, well, we kind of played that out in reality. So we borrowed $15,000 off the singer's bloody dad, and he had a forklift Toyota business. And we bought a Bedford van. We hired a coach trailer one way. We built drum road cases and road cases out of 3mm ply in my dad's garage. We loaded up that van with the bass player, the drummer, and Ashley. And one of the old road crew from Perfect Strangers decided that he was going to come to Sydney and make his mark in the world of the music industry, and jumped in as well. And we basically had no money, no fixed address or anything else. And we loaded that van up and we drove across the Nullarbor and turned up in Bondi in a well, kind of backpacker guest house thing. And started the trail from there. So there was kind of five of us living in a one bedroom flat down in Bondi, and started the path of trying to be rich and famous, which at 17 or 18 you believe is possible, but pretty naive when you look back at it. But you know, we started getting some gigs, and that's where I first met Tony Grace. I don't know if you know Tony. He's at Harbour Agency in Sydney, part of the Mushroom Group in the Michael Gudinski clan. So you sort of had Tony Grace in Sydney and you had Frank Stavala in Melbourne, and they sort of ran the operation from Premier Harbour down here to Harbour Agency up there. And Tony's still at Harbour today, and I still book a lot of Australia's leading big name artists off him. And I remember he gave me my first opportunity and gave the boys a gig. So we must go back 34, 35 years, me and Gracie, and he hasn't changed a bit. He's still a meat and potato man, and but you know, the music industry and the artists love him because he protects them and looks after them. And it's funny because I still work with a lot of the musicians and talent on all the events and corporate events we do, and I still deal with Tony today. So we slogged it out in Sydney for quite some time, and it was bloody hard. Really hard, hardest probably thing and hardest path you could ever imagine of going there as a naive 17, 18 year old in the mid 80s and trying to get a gig against what was happening in the music scene then, which was phenomenally huge.
But at least in those days, there were venues.
There were venues. And I distinctly remember Mark Lazotte, Diesel, who used to play in the backstage bar in Perth at the back of a nightclub, and Jimmy Barnes walked in one night and saw Mark and helped Mark get him going. And I remember seeing Mark, well, it was Johnny Diesel and the Injectors back then, play at the Sydney Cove Tavern, and that sort of gave me some inspiration of, well, bloody hell, it is possible for a musician from Perth and an artist from Perth to have a go and get there. And that gave us a bit of inspo, and we slogged it out there for a while. And then I realised that I probably needed to do a little bit more than what I was doing with these guys. So I got in touch with a guy called Harding Richards. Harding, I believe, runs a entertainment bloody music booking agency in the western suburbs there in Sydney, I think. But back then he had a company called Liquid Crystal Management. And he worked out of a basement in his parents' house in Terry Hills. So I was doing the commute up to Terry Hills and working with him and booking bands in. He had the contract for Moby Dicks up at Wild Beach. the Avalon RSL and everything else.
Yeah, remember all
and that's where I got to know Mark Callahan from Gangajang. So Mark was also an A&R guy back then. And we used to put Gangajang into the Avalon RSL, and Ivor Davies was living at Wild Beach, and he was doing some stuff at Wild Beach from Ice House. And so I sort of entrenched our way into, yeah, absolutely. Well, Perth too. There's a background there with all that. So that was kind of like where that all began. But, you know, as always happens, the band, I was at work during the day and the band started punching each other and fighting and carrying on and no money and bloody, you know, smoking weed and losing their shit and buying bloody, I think the Maoris had all the hash that they were selling down at the Bondi Hotel, and they had it lined up through the door frames back then. And you'd go in and basically they'd pull the hash out of the door frame and hand it across. I think they were spending too much time doing that instead of actually writing music and doing music. But as I reflect on it, must have been bloody hard for them. At least I had something to do during the day. They were just basically locked up in a 3x3 cubicle. And when you've got a drummer, a bass player, a guitar player, a singer, I mean, you can't get bigger three different personalities locked away in Sydney with not much money. You know, obviously collecting government benefits and pooling our funds and trying to live. So it got to a point where, you know, I just sort of thought, this is too bloody hard, let's move to Melbourne. So I convinced them all that Sydney was kind of destroying us, and it was hard work, and I had a lot of family and relatives down here in Melbourne. My brother was living here at the time. So I had been to Melbourne on a few occasions before with family and everything. So we packed up our Bongo van, the old Ford Transit, and we drove down to Melbourne and basically turned up at my brother's doorstep in Hawthorne, and we sort of camped there for about a week until we ended up at the Prince of Wales Hotel and got one of their four-bedroom bloody single-bed bloody rooms back then, when the Prince of the Wales was pretty grungy down there on Fitzroy Street in the 80s and a lot going on. Shackled up in there, and we started having a crack in Melbourne, but it was sort of the writing was on the wall. It started kind of falling apart, and I was just like, shit, I need to earn some money, and I need to probably start thinking about what I'm going to do, because these guys are kind of going to go off on their own tangent. And so I'd heard about a bloke called Ross Edwards from Concert Crewing Services, who basically employed loaders. So I gave Ross a call, and he said to me, can you start? I think it was on a Thursday or Friday. He said, can you start on the Saturday? Or gave me 36 hours notice, I think. And I was young and everything else, 18 or 19. And yeah, absolutely. So I said, where do I got to be? He goes, you need to be at Keyong. I went, okay, no worries. Where's Keyong? So I worked all that out and everything else. Because obviously back then, no Google Maps, no bloody iPhones, nothing really. And in a foreign city. So I've turned up there to start work on a bump out. And it was actually David Bowie's Glass Spider tour. And yeah, that was my first gig. And unfortunately, until this day, I never got to see Bowie play, because that night, as Melbourne is renowned for its magnificent weather in the middle of summer, we had a storm come through that was just out of control. Half the spider, back then the stage set was a huge spider when he did the Glass Spider tour. Half the spider fell down, and I think we had Frank Greer's stage back then and the ground support system, I think sort of at Keyong there. And anyway, half of it collapsed. Show was called off. Much to the delight of a lot of the other loaders, because it meant started bumping out early and it wasn't going to be so harsh. And I think on that gig is when I met guys like Tim Bradsmith, who was working here in lighting, and a whole bunch of other guys that I'm still friends with today and keeping contact. So we worked pretty much through the night. My first experience of loading out a concert, which was a quick, harsh reality of bloody hell, how hard does this work? And back then, money was good. It was very unionised down here, and had a lot of backing from the coffin cheaters as well, who were here. So we were getting paid ridiculous money in 86, 87, you know, something like 25, 30 bucks an hour. Public holidays, double time and a half and everything else. So we had to join the union. That was the only way you get a gig with concert crewing. And then it got to the point, it's 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and then they asked for volunteers, and I was like, well, what's the volunteer deal? And it's, I just thought, shit, I need to impress. It's my first gig. So I stuck my hand up. Anyway, little did I know that that volunteer gig was, once you loaded the Pantex of the touring stuff, you actually got to go to the airport, unload that gear and load it onto Bowie's planes to fly it back. So I think my first shift was something like 22 hours. That's why I kind of like look at the OH&S and things like that these days. I mean, you know, we would be doing 20, 24 hours, 26, 32 hours straight, you know what I mean? And unassisted, well, for me, unassisted with anything else but pure adrenaline and just, you know, hard work, empathy, and just kept that mindset of there's money coming in the bank, there's money coming in the bank. And so that was my first gig as a loader. And then that next week, back at Kooyong, we did Stevie Wonder. So they basically put the whole rig in. I think it was Frank Greer, as I said, out of Adelaide. I think he had all the big staging stuff. We did Stevie Wonder the week later, and I was on that gig then. And then Ross pretty much put me on every show that I wanted to do, from bloody, you know, Crowded House at the Underground here, or the Metro Theatre on New Year's Eve, to the Pier Hotel in Frankston. And it's kind of funny because I live in Mount Eliza now, down on the Mount Mornington Peninsula, and I still drive past the Pier Hotel, and those steel steps at the back have not changed at all from loading cases in and out. And I say to my 16-year-old daughter, Jasmine, I'm going, I've loaded road cases and double four-ways and more PA and more equipment up and down those stairs than anyone can ever bloody remember. And same as at the venue, which is obviously no longer here in Melbourne, down by the Palace where it was. Mm-hmm. I remember we were doing John Stevens' Noise Works downstairs and the Cult upstairs on Christmas Eve one year, and bloody pulling that out. So, you know, they were sort of hard work and hard days, you know, and I think I loaded with Ross for probably, you know, a couple of years, and then finally, you know, he was putting me in a crew boss situations, which wasn't so hard. But, you know, I think the grounding and the thing for me there was I got to see some of the most amazing spectacles I think anyone could ever see from a production and design point of view. Pink Floyd's Momentary Lapse of Reason tour, I was the guy on the pig and the bed. So when it came out over the audience and did the whole hovering, and we had a couple of times where she deflated. I know it deflated at East Fremantle Oval over in Perth at one occasion. But I was just wondering whether you'd be able to do that today with the OH&S and everything that's around, you know, fire a bed flying across 10,000-15,000 people with pyro going off it, and then a bloody huge ball with these red eyes, you know, the pig coming out, and it was, you know, not that far above people's hands, you know, you could almost touch the bloody thing. I mean, it was all rigged by Rigger Tony back in the day here and everything else. So, you know, that was a real special moment, meeting Dave Gilmore and the whole Floyd outfit. Most humble humans I think I've ever met out of anyone that's had so much success. Stevie Wonder was another amazing guy, an amazing memory. I remember that was my second gig ever at Kooyong, and I was told to go to Stevie Wonder's dressing room and grab his keyboard. He had a keyboard that he would have in his dressing room that he'd obviously play before he went on and everything else. So I was like, I can't go to Stevie Wonder's bloody dressing room. I'm just bloody naive kid on my second gig. Like, you know, and when you're told by an American crew boss back in those days, you genuinely didn't argue. So I went there expecting, you know, just to knock on the door and speak to security or someone and get the keyboard. And the door opened and it was one of the backing vocalists from the band. And she said, you know, what up? I was like, I need to get Stevie's keyboard to load for the truck. And he was like, who there? You know what I mean? And I just said, I just come to get the keyboard. And he asked me, you know, what's your name? I said, oh, Dave, you know. He goes, come in. So I walked in and he was sitting in front of a mirror and the glasses were off and I could see the whites of his eyes, you know, and the hairdresser was doing his plaits and everything there. And he said, come here. And so I walked up next to him and he goes, I just want to thank you for everything you guys do for my shows. And I was like, whoa, And he goes, grab it. So it was like literally right in front of him. So I just grabbed the keyboard and like ran out of the thing going, whoa, how cool was that? You know, that was something that will certainly take to the grave with me is the day that that I grabbed that keyboard. And, you know, all those things from, you know, even George Michael, the Faith Tour, to John Cougar Mellencamp, to, you know, the Australian artists. I mean, the 80s were such a big live music, you know, environment and experience. And I think it was probably the best grounding that I've ever had was actually doing that and seeing what you see, because you just learnt the craft of kabuki drops. You learnt what was back then, it was very lights and par cans and stuff. You got to learn production. You got to learn design. You got to learn showcraft. And it's stuff that you can't teach in school, unless you're out there doing it physically and working with some of these icons and greats of the music industry and the rock and roll industry and set designers and things like that. So I kind of got to a point where, you know, it's hard to say, but I was kind of 21 and nearly burnt out. I mean, we just worked and worked and worked and worked through the season. It was full on. So I decided to go back to Perth from Melbourne. I think it was 1988, 89. Mick Jagger came out without the Rolling Stones on the Mick Jagger solo tour. And he was earmarked to play Burswood Dome, which I'd never heard of. And obviously we know what happened to it. It's car parked now. Yeah. So I went back there with Jagger in that year, and I got a lift in one of the trucks from Showtech or whoever it was. Bloody, I can't remember. In all honesty, I just remember we did his solo tour and he was bloody shitty ass just between me and you and the rest of the people that are going to tune in. I mean, you know, some artists, you know, like the 1D guys, Harry Styles and all them, you know, all, some can do it, but when you ain't got the Stones, you know, I guess it was kind of hard. And he wasn't doing Stone songs, obviously. It was mixed stuff, and I don't think it went down overly well, but it certainly, you know, imploded at Burswood Dome, because I think it was the first concert that was ever there, and I turned up there, and a guy called Terry Kranswick was the technical manager there, and Andrew Firm was the entertainment manager and those guys. And, you know, I'd come from the east and everything else, and they'd come pretty much out of the Perth Entertainment Centre, I think, and moved across there. But one thing I do remember is walking into that theatre there, which is now called Crown Theatre, I believe, going, my God, this is one of the most magnificent venues I've stumbled across. And then 2,200 seats and everything else. And I thought, oh, I wouldn't mind hanging around here. So I did Jagger there, and that, you know, the audio, you know, issues were beyond control. It was just terrible. And then we went out of that into Phil Collins, had the same issues. And then I think they kind of decided that, you know, it wasn't probably built for concerts. I think it got better over the years. They spent millions of dollars on acoustic paneling and everything else, but I think at the end of the day, you know, that environment, you probably just want to pull it down, which they did in the end. But but what that did, it gave me an opportunity to do some theater experience. So I ended up becoming the head mechanist in the theater there, and that was just a great experience, because I'd done the rock and roll and then I moved into theater. And one thing I kind of thought about over the journey was, if you're going to survive in this industry, you need to have a little bit of everything and a bit of jack of all trades in this industry. So, you know, I'd done the rock and roll and now it was time for theatre. I remember working on the Buddy Holly story for 6, 8, 9, 10 weeks or so, and became quite good friends with Doug Parkinson, who played the Big Bopper. Hell of a bloke, just had his heart bloody surgery at the time and was keen to show the scars and sip a couple of Jack Daniels each night with me. And Lucius Borich, Kevin Borich's son, was on the drums in the house band back then. That was a bloody great show, and it was a great story. So it had a lot to do with that. And then we did the Sydney Dance Company's Beauty and the Beast, which was creative genius, whoever put that together. It was a brilliant show.
Yeah, that was Graham Murphy.
Yeah, that was a brilliant show. Yeah. thoroughly enjoyed that. So I had that diversity of, you know, Sydney Dance Company, and, you know, we were doing, you know, Buddy Holly's story. Then we're doing concerts from Cliff Richard to everything else, where I met another guy called Barry Brody, who's still a lifelong friend and was one of the best guitar techs and guys going around in the country before it's Chris Rogers, I better not forget him. So Baz and I became good mates, and then I ended up, you know, as the head mech, getting Baz on board and working there pretty much full time with us. And then we did the Series 3 BMW launch there, which was, I mean, these are early 90s production budgets, you know. BMW, I think the production house or agency was called Park Avenue or Park Lane, London. And they did the Series 3 launch in there. And basically, we basically built this huge set. We recreated 42nd Street pretty much for the Series 3 launch. And then they would fly in a junket out of each region of Asia each time, and do the, so we did like 20 shows on the same show, but to different audience each time that they were flown in and everything else. And that was a great experience, seeing the corporate side of, oh, hello, look at this, you know, there's bloody big budgets in corporate and there's creativity and there's all that sort of thing involved. So I love that, you know, part of the process there. And then I became the entertainment booker for the lounge there and everything else. And so, you know, back into the musical side of things, where I was booking the lobby lounge there for entertainment and Rene Gayers and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I was back into the old way of things and still touching on the corporate, still touching on the theatre. And then Paul McNamee appeared with a guy called Charlie Fancup to set up the Hopman Cup tennis tournament, which we basically had to cut a couple of holes in the concrete in the Burswood Dome and build a stadium each year. So I was in charge of the whole venue, you know, set up for that, and came very good friends with Paul actually. And yeah, I think I did. I was, even after, like, only recently when the Hopman Cup finished, I was still producing as DJ Global their New Year's Eve ball. So I think I had about 25 years affiliation with the Hopman Cup, even once the Tennis Australia took it away from Paul and changed the format and did what they did and moved the RAC arena, we were still producing Hopman Cup tennis. So, you know, I got my hand in some sport, which was the other box I wanted to tick. So, you know, I wanted to do rock and roll, theatre, sport and corporate, obviously, which was the next interesting path of where that sort of went. So then a bloke who probably had a big influence on my career and life early was a guy called Merv Jones, who hooked up with Terry Davenport and Gary Hackett and those guys, and they started staging Connections. So Merv put me into the Hyatt as a AV manager of a hotel. And I still have empathy for those guys that are in venues and hotels doing AV. It's not an easy job when you've got two customers and two clients plus a boss. So you've got the hotel to adhere to, you've got the client at the end of the day, plus you've got to hit your targets within the corporation that you're in. And I think, you know, Encore and AVP, and I think Ian Whitworth's guys in charge, you've got some venues now, and AVD. And so that was kind of the new frontier. I mean, I strongly believe that those guys pioneered that whole thing. Gary and Merv and Phil DeLange, and I think, and Terry Davenport, was the in-house model at hotels, which, you know, obviously worked very well for them. But it wasn't for me. It wasn't for me. You know, the whole hotel thing. So I got out of there. I said to Merv, if you don't move me back to the head office and let me start creating and producing and designing and using my 5 years, which felt like 20 years or 7 years in the industry of where I've touched and what I've done, that's pretty hard whacking an overhead projector and a slide projector into a meeting room, you know. And he was great. He brought me in under that wing, and I was there at the head office there for a long time. And that's where I came across John Smith, who you know very well as well. And John was, I thought John was a brilliant designer, and I still think he is to this day. I think he was ahead of the time with his design. He's a brilliant designer, and he's showcraft, and he's a brilliant event guy. I've got a lot of time for John Smith, and he worked for me for a period of time, and I keep in touch. He's got the Event Smith or something going now, or something. He was working on GP, I think that never happened. But yeah, I always was impressed with John because he was here in Melbourne with Terry Davenport back in those days.
So yeah, a lot of lifelong friendships, out of stage and connections and everything else. But you know, it was time to move on, and I became very good friends with a guy called Brad Mullen, who was actually working the Super League and Newcastle Entertainment, etc. So Brad and I hooked up, and he convinced me to buy a music store, Rockaby Records, selling CDs. Thank God we got out of that, eh? CDs, Jesus. And I think
well,
we just
go back to vinyl now.
Yeah, well, you can. That's the funny thing. My wife actually came home the other day with a Queen and Fleetwood Mac album from JB Hi-Fi. And I said, what the hell did you buy those for? She goes, I love Queen and bloody Fleetwood Mac. I said, yeah, but you can listen to it on Spotify or Apple Music or anything else. So I said, why'd you have to buy the vinyl? And by the way, how much were they? She says, $100. I said, you paid $50 a record. You've got to be kidding. I think, what were they? $1.99 back in the day? $2, something like that. She's paid $50 for a Fleetwood Mac bloody album and a bloody Queen album. And Jesus, for another 100 these days, you can go and see them live. Anyway, she's played the Queen record once from memory. So, yeah, look, that was just a way to keep in touch with the music industry. And Brad was keen on a promoting business. So we had a company called Green Melon International, which worked well. It was a little watermelon slice. I was obviously the green and he was the melon. So it worked kind of great. And we started promoting. Brad was a promoter. So we did Vibes on a Summer's Day. We did some Crusty Demons with Seth Enslow. We did a JV with Andrew McManus and the wrestling with Dennis Rodman, who bloody hurt himself before the first wrestling match or something or other and toured. And I was still doing corporate. So we amalgamated the corporate with promoting and intertwined them. And the goal was to become, I guess, something of a big touring and promoting and corporate entertainment events agency sort of thing. But, I did a bit of promoting post that in the early days of DG. It's kind of not my bag. I'm probably a little... I'm not ruthless enough, Trev. I'm too much of a nice guy, you know what I mean? I think if you want to be successful in that arena, then you've got to be a very ruthless, tough, hard business orientated person. And I'm more of a creative. I fell into having a good business. I'm an events guy that loves it and loves the passion and the adrenaline of it. And just so happened that it ended up kind of working out. And it's been a bloody roller coaster. I won't say that, but I'm certainly not the ruthless businessman that that you kind of need to be in that arena. That's for sure. I mean, everybody's sort of fighting over everything else, but I do take credit in the guys from Staying Alive, the BG show, Michael Clift and those guys that came out of Melbourne. I toured them in Australia and New Zealand way back. I had a good eye for talent and a good concept, and those guys were brilliant. And I think they're in their third or fourth year residency at the Excalibur in Vegas now. And I caught up with them a couple of years ago when I was in Vegas. Lucy and the 100% Kylie show, that turned into a great success for them, and I toured that as well. I owned the rights to the Shanghai Circus for a while and toured that and done some crazy stuff through that. But I figured I might as well go down to Crown Casino, get on the roulette wheel and go black or red at the end of the day, you know what I mean? Because I can't sit there worrying about if I'm going to sell the back row and make some money, you know what I mean? It's a tough game, and I admire a great deal the people like Paul Dainty, Michael Koppel, Michael Kandinsky, Andrew McManus is still out there having a go. I think the most creative, brilliant idea and everything of recent years is Red Hot Summer. I mean, that thing is absolutely killing it. I mean, you get that up in New South Wales, wouldn't you, in the regional areas?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, taking live music and that whole concept out to the regional areas just astounds me. No one actually thought of it before, you know what I mean? So that was a period in life there. And then, I started the whole DG Global thing probably straight after Green Melon, and was based in Perth, but I always had a burning desire to get back to Melbourne. Melbourne felt like home for me. So after a period of time, I, you know, my daughter was born and pretty much said to the wife, you know, if we don't go now, we never will. So it's nearly 15 years ago. We'd had the business here and I'd worked a lot here and done a lot here. And I was coming here all the time and still had friends here and everything from the old days. And it just felt right to sort of jump. And I had a lot of guidance and assistance from a guy called Mark Pennell, who at the time was married to Tara Moss, and Mark was an entrepreneur in many things, and his family had, his mum and dad were the first to bring international ice attractions to Australia. They were pioneers in that, and Mark was a smart guy, good writer for TV and many attributes. But best mates with Hugh Jackman, they lived together when Hugh came out of Whopper. So Mark sort of took me under his wing when I moved to Melbourne, and we did a lot of stuff, and we actually came up with the polo in the city concept. We were the ones that actually created that whole thing. We went to Dubai, Mark and I, and met with a guy called Ed Kennedy, who used to be the captain of the English polo team, but he worked for the Sheik at the time, and he ran the Sheik's polo and horse facilities in Dubai. So Mark and I went there, oh shit, must be at least 18 years ago, maybe, I don't know, I'd have to check. So we came up with that whole, with another guy called Angus James, that whole polo thing, of put it in the city. Basically, we wanted to do what bloody they did with the cricket, you know, the one day, as in take a test match and make it one day. Well, we wanted to take polo and use that indoor ball but outdoors because they're bigger, and we wanted to shorten the course, and we wanted to put music on and make it this whole thing. And we did the first one, and I think I lost about $100,000, so maybe not for me, but Mark pursued it, and he got Sydney, well, I think a guy called Yannick does Sydney, I don't know if it's still going or whatever happened, and he got Albert Park up. And but our idea was to have Hyde Park London, Central Park New York, Centennial Park, Sydney, or whatever, you know what I mean? So go to these great parks in these great cities of the world and have these tournaments and take it into the city. So we kind of got close, but I kind of moved on from that one. And I don't know, after several attempts at being an octopus and bloody sticking your hand in everything, I've just come back to the fact, look, you know, at the end of the day, just do what you're good at and what you love and stop trying to be everything to everyone. So I pretty much stuck with the whole, you know, corporate events, producing, designing, and the creative attributes of what I'm good at. You know, and whilst I've had all that experience in so many areas, you can't be good at everything. And one thing I've realised is that pick one and give it your all and be the best you can be at that. So that's kind of where I ended up with the whole DG Global kind of thing, and it's worked. I mean, you know, I've met some amazing people that have worked with me. I don't like using that word for me. We are one team and one mission here, and I'm probably a lot more flexible than most employers would be, but that's just how I roll. It's not about punching the time card, and it's not about, you know, how many hours did you do this week, and have you filled your timesheet out? And, you know, it's all about just creating magic is what my whole philosophy is. So, you know, and it brings into play all those things that you've done over 35 years now. I guess I'm 53 this year. So when you look back and go, shit, I've survived 35 years in the industry. So pandemic, the bloody coronavirus ain't going to get me, and you just battle through. And I mean, a bit the same as you with your 20 years with the special event, the events. I mean, you've been when you're around them so long, it just becomes your DNA. And you know, you actually don't know. Well, I don't know how to do anything else. I mean, this is what I'm built for. You know, this is why I'm here. And you know, all the sleepless nights and waking up at 3 a.m. with new ideas and different ideas and everything else kind of makes it worthwhile when you stand there and you see something that you thought of at 3 o'clock in the morning, or you see a certain bit of talent, or you do something, you know, spectacular come to fruition. You go, you know what, it's all worth it at the end of the day. And you know, I've had quite a few of those experiences over the journey. I'm talking too much. You haven't said a word.
Now, a constant throughout all this has been surfing. What's that mean to you?
Ah, that's the be all and end all. I think everybody needs something to let themselves out of the cage. That's my thing. That's where I've grown up doing that since I was about 8 years of age. You know, there's just something about the ocean. There's something about the water for me. There's something about even just staring at the water. I mean, shit, we live in Australia. We're surrounded by it. But, you know, that's just more of the adrenaline charge. I'm an adrenaline junkie, and I think that's why I've ended up in this industry, because there's no greater adrenaline than 5 minutes before doors and the bloody band hasn't finished sound checking and it's not sounding the way you want, and the bloody guy's running around with another light to hang in the roof because the other one's blown, and you're standing there going, fuck me, is this really going to happen? But you always get there. But that's the adrenaline and the sweaty palms, which you still get. So surfing, yeah, I mean, I've been blessed enough to have surfed all over the world, from Hawaii to El Salvador, which was a really interesting experience, to down Mexico. I was actually in Baja, Mexico earlier this year, but I've been right down Mexico surfing. I mean, you know, one of my best mates that I met through DG Global probably 9, maybe 9, 10 years ago is Martin Potter. I think it was the 1989 World Surfing Champ. And I don't get starstruck too much because of the Stevie Wonders and the Bowies and all those things that I've encountered in life. But when you meet guys like that, that sort of just, you know, the Kelly Slaters and these guys that surf the way they do and what they do, I kind of get a little, you know, starstruck. But I think it's more admiration than anything. It's kind of depressing that Easter's about to hit us and we've got no bells this year, that's for sure. So yeah, Potts lives down the coast and not far from me, and we hang out quite a bit. So he's been affected by this. He's on the world tour still. He's been on the world tour since he was 15, and he still is. He's a year older than me. He might be 54 this year. So he's commentating special comments around the world and still on tour. Started when he was 15. He's an amazing story. He's an amazing human. I got a lot of time for him. So I've been blessed enough to surf with him through the Mentawis and Indonesia. Another guy, Nick, I surf with a lot, and quite a few boys I surf with throughout the world. Hawaii, my first trip to Hawaii, I went over there, I don't know, might have been 2012, 2011. I mean, the influence of that on me there, I came back, I got a tattoo, a dog and a bloody F-100 truck. It kind of changed my world, you know, the North Shore of Hawaii. It's just got this certain aura about it that just, you know. So I think that's one thing that certainly kept me sane throughout the whole process is the surfing, and I still love it. And it's kind of the reason I live down the Mornington Peninsula, is that, you know, it's cold as it is at the moment, I can still get in the ocean, and there's just no better feeling than getting in that ocean and cleansing the soul, as one would say. Plus just the rush and the adrenaline from it. I was also lucky enough when I worked with IHG on their contracts, that we did a show in Abu Dhabi, 2012 again, I think. And they've just opened this wave pool here. I actually haven't been, but all my mates are at me to go to this wave pool here called Urban Surf. And it's got huge credits to it. It's very popular, apparently. And it's really, really good. It's state-of-the-art sort of thing. And so I went out in the middle of the desert at Wadi Adventure and surfed in this wave pool where I hired the pool for myself for an hour. It was the most surreal experience. It was unbelievable. So it's pretty hard to sort of do the whole urban surf thing after you've been out in the middle of the desert between sort of Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and then this pool's like out there. And the only thing there is university, from what I know. Where else have I been? Oh, obviously growing up in the Margaret River region, WA, as well, and here, and Bali's second home, and it's quite devastating what's happening there at the moment. So surfing's kept me grounded, and it's kept me enthused, and it's sort of whenever the world's sort of crashing in on me, I kind of get in the ocean, and things look a lot clearer and better once I do that. And it sort of keeps you active as well, you know what I mean? As you get in your 50s, you've kind of got to keep moving, otherwise you seize up. and that's what people are saying now. Oh, you should be happy sitting on the couch. And I'm like, well, I am for a couple of days, but then I sort of get a bit antsy about all that. So yeah, surfing's definitely been a big thing, and still is in my life, and it will continue to be that way, I would say, for as long as I can do it. And the good news is it's one of those sports. I think it's a bit like golf. You can do it for a long time, and I'm still avoiding the longboard, so I haven't got to that stage yet. It's funny though, I've been at Ian Whitworth. Ian likes to get in the ocean as well, and we've been trying to have a corporate surf as opposed to a corporate lunch together for a long time, but we haven't actually made it happen. So I'll challenge out to you, Mr. Whitworth, if you watch this at any point in time, we need to get that corporate surf, as he called it, which is kind of justified, I think. Apparently it's relationship building or something, maybe.
Well, it'd together. Be a nice change from corporate golf days.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not. I don't have the attention span for golf, Trev. just can't, you know, maybe play one good hole out of 9 or 18. I don't have the attention span. It's like all my team here are like, are you listening? Because unless you get me from the word go, I'm gone. It won't stop. You know what I mean? I have 3 million things going through there, and unless you're actually getting in. So they generally try and keep our meetings internally to about 4 minutes, because that's about the only time. That's about my length of my attention span before I've got 300 other things coming into my brain. So, yeah, that's pretty much, you know, how I got here. You know, a couple of memorable things. I was pretty chuffed to win the Australian Event Awards. Event management company agency or whatever the year back in, I think that was after we did Qatar Sydney, which I think you were at Qatar Sydney, weren't you? Did you come down to that when we had Kylie Minogue? I bought Kylie Minogue out from London. Bigger than Ben Hur, that show. Bloody amazing. Unbelievable. And I'm pretty chuffed to win New South Wales Event of the Year for that as well. So, and Kylie was, you know, she was a pleasure to work with. That was a great show. Another highlight, I think, for me was IHG, Intercontinental Hotel Group, worked with for 10, 11 years producing their biannual general managers convention, Shenzhen. We did an amazing show there at the Shaolin monks and turned them into a pantomime, and they scaled a ship and rescued one of the senior executives. And, you know, it was a massive production, a huge show. As I mentioned, Abu Dhabi. We did the IHG show there, and I remember John Smith was on that gig for me. And John's a motorhead enthusiast, loves his car racing and everything else. And they just finished building that Ferrari world and that roller coaster. John loves roller coasters as well, and they just finished building that. And I'm 50-50 on roller coasters. But I remember he got me on that bloody Ferrari roller coaster, and nearly bloody the G-force on the takeoff of that thing nearly blew the back of my head off. But I remember John kept going back for more, because obviously we were the production agency and kind of had free access to it. So, you know, I've been blessed. I've traveled the world, and, you know, America and the Middle East, and extensive experience through Asia and Singapore and Hong Kong and Shanghai. And, you know, to have what this business and industry's given me and to my family and to the people that have come through DG. You know, we're very fortunate, and, you know, we all sit back and go, shit, this is bad and everything else that's happening and everything else. Well, yeah, it is. But, you know, I think we've got to remain positive, and I think we've got to look at the good times that we've got out of this too, you know. And I don't think it's going to be as doom and gloom as the forecasters say, but hey, I'm no economist or anything else. But I remember, I mean, you'd remember the 87 crash. Our industry was boom, you know, first thing to go is the conference, the bloody staff awards night, the Christmas party, the brand activation, sell the new product and everything else. But once we got out of 87, you know,
88 helped to kick it.
Yeah. But, you know, 88 to 92 were golden years in the entertainment and events industry, you know what I mean? And I'm kind of hoping that turns as well, because I also believe that companies are going to need to reassure their people, their shareholders, and everyone else that they're okay. people who are going to have to sell stuff, be it a phone or whatever, they're going to have to market, they're going to have to get it out there. And you know, everybody's on about this virtual stuff. That's bullshit. You can't get a handshake, a hug, or a beer, or say, how the fuck are you, over the internet. You know what I mean? You can't replace the human interaction. I mean, I'm old school. I don't even like talking to people on the phone. Send me a text, let me know where we're going to meet. You know what I mean? Like, you can't get that. You can't see the whites of people's eyes. You can't converse. You can't do that doing what we're doing right now. You know what I mean? And it's a lot easier now because I've known you for bloody nearly 20 years as well. So it's kind of, you know, everybody's on about virtual stuff and pre-record this, and we'll do the awards night over the internet and Zoom and all this. And I'm like, well, you can, but you're not going to get everyone's attention, because if they're going to be watching it at home, or they're going to be watching it in their office, or they're going to be in isolation, or wherever they're going to be, they're going to get distracted because they're going to pick up their phone. And probably the longest I haven't looked at my phone in the last month talking to you. But you know what I mean? There's so many distractions. Instagram, Facebook, bloody TV. I mean, every household, and I've only got my wife and my daughter, but we're a 4 or 5 screen family a night. So we've got three of us are looking at the phone in between on the ads. We've got the TV going, and one might have the laptop over there. So 3, 4, that's 5 screens are running between 3 of us in the one house. So how the hell are you going to get my attention? You know what I mean? If I'm watching an awards night, or I'm watching a product launch, or a seminar, or a webinar, it's kudos to those that can do it. But I still strongly believe that we're going to need to get together more than ever after this. And at the end of the day, you know, I want to come and have a beer with you and congratulate you on your bloody 20 years as well. You know what I mean? And we can't do that sitting here, you know. If I had a beer here and you had a beer there, it's not the same as us having a beer, you know, regardless, even if you don't drink beer and drink wine or whatever, you know what I mean? So, you know, I think it's going to be tough. Absolutely. Will I survive? Absolutely. Is it going to be easy? No. Nothing's fucking easy. And if you think it is, you're a fucking idiot, because it's not. It's going to be tough. Everything is hard. And if it wasn't, everybody would be doing it, you know. And there's ways around it, and it's how you adapt, and it's just how you deal with it. And you just got to sometimes go, well, it is what it is. I'm going to go with the flow. And the only thing I'm pissed off about is they might not let me go surfing for the next couple of months. I've got more time on my hands than I ever have.
But don't you have a private beach?
I'm kind of trying to sneak around a bit, Trev, but bloody, you know, after I saw, was it yesterday? They just shut down all the Gold Coast beaches and Snapper Rock. I think Sydney won't be far behind, will they? They've done Bondi and Manly. I think they're about to do the whole coast, I think, for Easter, aren't they? What's going on up there?
Yeah, and then down your way, St Kilda's closed, and
they pulled all there. That. I mean, Melbourne had a freak day. We get one every year where it was above 28 degrees in March. and you remember them because you don't get many down here. And I think half of Melbourne went down the morning to Peninsula. So then it all of a sudden it became a hotspot for tourists and everything else. So, you know, it was like Boxing Day, you know, on a 40-degree day in Melbourne. The beach car parks are packed and everybody's out thinking it's bloody Christmas, you know. And it's like, hang on a minute, we're in the middle of a pandemic, ladies and gentlemen. You might need to stay home, you know. So I'm trying to try and abide by the rules and regulations of what they're enforcing at the end of the day. I mean, the hardest thing is having a 16-year-old daughter sitting at home wanting to do something, and then we just got told that she's going to be homeschooled pretty much for the next term. So, I mean, what she's at Toorak College in Mount Eliza, and what they've done is phenomenal with their cloud-based systems and their online learning. It's phenomenal. But, you know, strange times. And when you and I finish writing our bloody book and leave a legacy behind for our grandkids, mate, or whatever, we'll be able to say, we survived the pandemic, eh? Not many can do that, but
yeah. Well, David Green, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend the last hour with you.
An hour? Shit. Jeez, sorry about that.
No, well done. Well done. I appreciate that. And
No, it's been good, Trev. Always good to talk to you, mate. You're a good listener.
Thanks for listening. I'd love to get your feedback, so please share your rating and comments in the appropriate place of your player or on the project website page. This podcast is produced by me, Trevor Connell, and edited by Samantha Latto. The theme music is composed and played by Duncan Latto.